Okay. Alright, so yeah, thanks for the invitation, the opportunity to talk. So I'm gonna give a rare experimental talk at Perimeter. I'm gonna talk about an effort over the past few years to identify and explore charge density ring order in cuprate superconductors, mostly using a technique resonant X-ray scattering that we've been working on in my group, so we'll see. Okay. So this work I'm gonna talk about is part of a quite large collaboration at this point. Key people, or perhaps the key person in this collaboration is Andrew Askar, who's a graduate student, or former graduate student in my group. So he just finished his PhD a few months ago, and is unfortunately leaving physics. As you'll see, he's done a tremendous amount of work spanning and making important contributions to this area. In addition to Andrew, though, there's a whole assortment of people that have been involved in the work I'm gonna talk about. A lot of the experiments, almost all the experiments I'm gonna talk about, were performed at the Canadian Light Source in Saskatoon. There's a BeamLine scientist there. Samples come from the UBC group for YMCO, lanthanum-based cuprates from Brookhaven and Toronto, and also Dresden. And then some of the early work, the first discovery of CDW order in YBCO was a collaboration with Giringelli, Brankovic, and the Keimer group, an excellent group of researchers made a very important contribution. I'm going to touch on some more recent work in collaboration with Andrea Damascelli and Ricardo Coleman. And then finally, I may also have time to touch on a theory collaboration with Sabir, Lauren Hayward, Roger Malko, and then some separate work with Michelle Gengrau and Ji Hao at Harvard. Okay, so I think that's covering it most certainly. So, quick outline. I'm going to talk about charge density wave order and cuprates, and just to review this from a bit of a historical perspective. Then I'm going to get into a comparison of charge density wave order amongst different families, different structural genomes of the cuprate materials. And the idea there is that what we do, at least from an experimental perspective, is to come up with a more general understanding of the cuprate phase diagram, and specifically the charge density wave order. And we want to know what are the generic aspects of this, and what are material-specific things that might be related to disorder in material or particular structural configuration of material. Next, I'm going to get into the symmetry of the charge density wave order. So the symmetry of the orbital of the CDW form factor that Sabir motivated and motivated the experimental investigation of this, and then I'll talk about yesterday. And then finally, if time permits, I'm going to get into talking about new work, and that's our investigations of C4 symmetry breaking, or nematicity, in stripe order cuprates, and how that is related to CDW order and also to structural distortions in the materials. Okay, so that's a lot. We'll see how far we go. So a starting point for this is to look at the cuprate material, the crystal structure here. So these materials are layered compounds where the key unit, pre-structural unit, is a square lattice of copper in red and oxygen in blue. And in this compound here, LSCO, there's two of these layers in the unit cell. And separating these layers is some spacer with lanthanum, strontium, and oxygen. And if you vary the strontium to lanthanum ratio, what one can do is vary the hole doping in this copper oxide plates. So the unknown parent compound has a single hole in the copper dx squared minus y squared orbital, but if you dope holes, those holes go primarily into the oxygen px and oxygen py orbitals. So from my view, the minimal electronic structure I need to describe the majority of the experiments I'm going to talk about is a three-band model comprised of these three bands. And as people have talked about here, one could downfold this into a single-band model and aspects of the key phrase we did describe in the same way models. But what I'm going to talk about, I really need to incorporate oxygen with your real more explicitly. Okay, so if one does dope holes into the copper oxide planes, we map out this kind of phase diagram. I'm just going to see if I can unplug this and plug it back in to get better resolution. Not working on a lot. Okay, so crummy. We're going to live with crummy resolution. So here's the key rate phase diagram, the generic one that has been talked about for many years. So we have an infrared magnetic mod insulator that gets rapidly suppressed with increasing doping. And then above that doping, we get the onset of some D-wave superconductivity. In addition to that, there's these strange phases that Sabir talked about, such as the pseudo-gap phase, which, although we've been studying cuprates for close to 30 years, there's as yet no consensus on the basic character of the pseudogap phase or the origin of this phase. In addition, there's a strange metal here and something more conventional for any liquid like state at sufficiently high doping. So a new wrinkle or what's emerged in the past few years, and what I'll discuss, is that there's also a charge density wave ordered state that is a feature of the generic cuprate phase diagram in this underdoped region, and it spans roughly this region from the onset of superconductivity to somewhere in the optimally doped or overdoped region of the phase diagram.
And does this differ much between LDCO and LIPCO?
Pardon?
Does it differ much between the lanthanum and the yttrium cuprate?
I'll describe in detail sort of what the similarities are, what the differences are as I progress through the talk. So this density wave order was first found or identified in some seminal measurements by John Tranquata in 1995. So what he found using elastic neutron scattering was some super lattice peaks or bright peaks. So here is the neutron scattering intensity along the y-axis, and on the x-axis is some reciprocal lattice vector, so spanning somewhere in our Q space. The cuts are shown in that panel A. And in this top panel, in the blue panel, we have evidence for a charge density wave order, and then related to that by a related Q vector is a spin density wave order, and they drew a cartoon picture of what kind of order could produce this sort of density wave pattern. And what one has is a spin charge kind of strike, where one has a unidirectional order so that there's a Q along a one direction. So this isn't a checkerboard pattern, it's a stripe-like pattern with stripes of charge separating some regions that have antiferromagnetic ordering. So some of the features, characteristic features of stripes in the lanthanum-based cuprates are there's unidirectional order in both spin and charge order. There has been a story about the CDW order having a period that's somewhat commensurate with the lattice, approximately 4 unit cells would be the period. In fact, the measurements are rarely ever truly commensurate, and almost all of the measurements are incommensurate. So whether the CDW is really actually commensurate in the 1/8 doped compounds is, I think, in fact, a bit of a myth if one examines this. It is clear that the density wave order is associated with the suppression of superconductivity. So in green here is the superconducting transition temperature as a function of doping in this compound, lanthanum barium copper oxide. And although TC is reasonably high at 30 Kelvin, above and below 1/8 doping, it is dramatically suppressed down to 4 Kelvin or almost zero at this 1/8 doping. And that seems to be coincident with where the CDW order, spin and charge order, is most pronounced, has the greatest intensity. And then a final fact is that this density wave order in this family of materials seems to be stabilized by a structural distortion of the compounds where the copper-oxygen octahedra tilts along the copper-oxygen bond, which breaks the rotational symmetry within a an individual copper oxide plane, and that seems to somehow be associated with stabilizing a unidirectional density wave order. So the message is out of this is that there's competition between CDW order and superconductivity. There's some association with the individual structure, and in this case, there's spinning charge order. So for a long time, I think there was many skeptics in the Cuprate field who thought this was interesting, but perhaps a peculiar oddity that really had nothing to do with the generic story of the Cuprate materials, and was a bit of a red herring to explore. So arguments were that maybe this was just a jump effect associated with disorder in these compounds, or that it was associated with this funny structural distortion that only happens in this one material and it doesn't happen in VSCO or YBCO or other great materials. And I think over time, and as we'll show, that that perception is incorrect. So some of the earlier evidence indicating that CDW orders in fact generic to cuprates came from a whole host of tunneling STM measurements from the Davis group, Seamus Davis group, the Yazdani group, Kapitolnik, Jenny Hoffman. I'm just showing some work from Seamus Davis' group here, showing STM measurements, and Sabir showed these same measurements the other day, in two compounds, sodium dope copper oxychloride and dysprosium dope bismuth 2212, with different structures and different chemical formulas, yet in both of these compounds, some charge density wave order is observed on the surfaces of these materials, and we now I think it has something at least to do with what's observed in the lanthanum based cuprates. One of the big questions though was whether density wave order also occurs in yttrium-bearing copper oxide, YBCO. So this compound here is a bit of a special compound in a history of cuprate. So it's special for, I think, a few reasons. One, perhaps most importantly, is that it can be prepared with very low levels of disorder. So so this is just a bit of chemistry. So maybe this is the wrong audience for that, but I'm going to go through a bit of chemistry. So when one grows material, often we write down a chemical formula, but that's not maybe not what you actually have. You might have some of your bismuth in a strontium site and vice versa, and the actual material can have a fair bit of disorder in it. In addition, when we say look at the lanthanum-based cuprates, we're substituting strontium for lanthanum in order to dope holes into the copper oxide planes. That naturally introduces some disorder potential that is lying somewhat nearby the copper oxide plane. So the effect of that level of disorder is a bit unclear. In contrast, YBCO still has some disorder, but it for reasons just associated with the relative ionic radius of the different elements, it really comes out pretty close to stoichiometry with very little yttrium in the bearing site and vice versa. In addition, the doping is done by oxygen, which resides in this chain layer here, this spacer layer. And it's reasonably well separated from the copper oxide planes, and it seems to have less of an influence on scattering of quasi particles. So consequently, the mean free paths that are measured in this material are much, much larger than those found in the other cuprate materials. So this is one of our most pristine cases of a cuprate material. So one wonders then if density wave order is also observed in these compounds. So back in 07, some indirect evidence came about that suggested this might in fact be the case, and that was these quantum oscillation experiments that Bhaskaran talked about on Monday. I think Sabir might have mentioned yesterday. And the one explanation for that was, so they observed an unexpected electron pocket from the quantum oscillations experiments, whereas one might have predicted a large hole pocket. And one explanation for that would be that the Fermi surface gets or the Berlin zone gets folded up by some translational symmetry breaking, some density wave order, giving rise to a smaller Fermi surface. So that was a speculation. Evidence that this might be occurring, more direct evidence, came from NMR measurements by Marc-Henri Julien's group, where they found a splitting of some NMR peak in a high magnetic field and low temperature. So this is a NMR peak associated with the copper oxide planes of the copper site, and then high field and low temperature. This single peak splits into two peaks, indicating you have two distinct copper sites, which would be some evidence for some kind of charred wood. But for my money, the most direct evidence for density wave order came from a scattering experiment. And these are really beautiful experiments by the Milano group, by Giringelli. I think Brekovich was the first one to actually kind of pick this out of the data. And then this was a collaboration with Keimer's group at Max Planck. I had a very, very small part in this, as evidenced by being stuffed in the middle, almost the exact middle of this giant object. Okay? So this was with resonant X-ray scattering, this technique.
I think it's called central role.
What's that?
I think it's called central role.
Okay, I'll play the central role. Anyways, so they found, so they did the first experiments on me. They found a density wave order. So previously we had looked for this density wave order in YPCO and even wrote a paper saying we couldn't find it. They actually went and found it, okay? So what they did find, here's in Q space along the A or the B axis of the sample, they're seeing Bragg peaks or super lattice peaks that are broad, indicating some short range order, are peaked at around a Q vector of 0.3, which is different than what's observed in lanthanum based Q rates, but it's clearly indicative of some charge density wave order in YBCO in the bulk of the material. Very interestingly, here's the temperature dependence of this Bragg peak intensity. It's onsetting somewhere around 160 Kelvin, or at least that's where we can resolve this out of the noisy background. And then it increases with in intensity as temperature is lowered. But then once superconductivity onsets, the intensity of this CDW order decreases. So this is providing us some clear indication that there's a competition between the superconductivity and the charge density wave order, where the superconductivity is suppressing the CDW order.
But that's not actually the TC, right? That's not actually the TC.
This is TC, so you can measure TC separately with susceptibility or resistivity. That's TC of the superconductivity. What's shown in here is the intensity of the CDW order.
Oh, right. No, I just thought that the TC for YPCO was actually higher.
This is an underdoped sample of YPCO, okay? So so if we look at, say we look at this generic superconducting phase diagram, here would be optimal doping, we're at doping around here, okay? Where TC is low, okay? All right, so that's where the first experiments were discovered. Separately, another group using hard X-ray scattering, not this resonant X-ray scattering technique, also found a CDW order in YBCO in some oxygen-ordered samples. And they found that in zero field, in black, is a similar temperature dependence. What they were also able to do, though, is apply a high magnetic field. So they can apply 17 Tesla to their samples. And what that does is it suppresses superconductivity. And in red is the 17 Tesla data. So above TC, the magnetic field is doing a little to the CDW scattering intensity. But below TC, where the field is presumably introducing vortices and suppressing superconductivity, it's leading to an enhancement of the CDW intensity and to a lengthening of the CDW correlation length.
Dave, one question. Is it possible to put a bound on the amount of charge modulation from these experiments?
How much of a modulation in charge density one actually has?
Because I remember in some of the very dramatic charge density,
the percentage was very low, like 1%. So is it still the case here?
It's safe to say that it's low. So it's not like a half-filled charge stripe, that kind of original picture drawn from Quetta of undoped regions and then a half-filled charge stripe. It's not what occurs in the lanthanum-based Q-grades, and it's not what is occurring in YBCO. However, there is no sort of clear and particularly compelling measurement that I know of that provides a really well-defined number on what the charge density modulation actually is. So it turns out to be hard to do.
The estimates from STM is that the amplitude of the modulation is 0.03 E. Now that might sound like very small, but that's but relative to the doped hole density, which is 0.1 E, it's about a 30% modulation. So that's quite hard.
So how do they, who's that from? Is that from?
It's just estimates from STM, you know.
Who's estimate?
Well, Seamus.
Seamus?
Yeah, from the distortion. I mean, okay, 0.03, 0.02 E is generally the number they say.
So one of the problems with I've asked Seamus about that. He's never sort of given me this number.
Okay. No.
One of the problems with STM measurements is that they're measuring some quantity that's associated with modulation at density states, often at a particular energy. But that is, you know, would have some relationship to charge density, but it's not actually measuring charge. Charge would be more associated with the integrated density, say integrated unoccupied densities of states, or integrated occupied densities of states. I think it's not clear that they're able to do that up to a high enough energy to get a particularly accurate.
Because the fact that it is small is also consistent with the thermodynamic absence of strong thermodynamic signals. There is a large condensation energy, then it show up in thermodynamics.
So I think the evidence we do have indicates that it could be a smaller charge density modulation. It depends on kind of on the, you know, the theory, whether, you know, whether that's important or not.
It's at least as important as the superconductivity to all the energy scales.
In superconductivity, you see
superconductivity is tiny.
You see change in specific key jumps and. Very strong thermodynamic signals.
It's a strong job, but you know,
so here,
superconductivity.
So I'd say there's a couple of things that are clear. That there's, so when you have a modulation in charge density, you would also have a modulation in the lattice. So your ionic positions change. You also have sort of changes in your electronic structure. So it might be that your hopping modulates in space, or other parameters, but basically all the relevant parameters in the material will be modulated. So different probes, I think, certainly what we do, resonant X-ray scattering, the intensity of that bright peak that's seen by Chirangeli, we've done some work on this in our group, and we find that this is associated with a shift in the energy of the copper 2P to 3D electronic transition. So the most direct thing that we can deduce is that we're not perhaps directly seeing a modulation in charge density in orbital occupation. We're seeing something, some shift in an electronic energy level. And that could all be related to a modulation in charge density, would be sort of perhaps one of the more reasonable explanations. So it ends up being a little bit complicated to deduce that. Magnitude of
the charge modulation. Wait, the local phase, when you apply the magnetic fields to enhance this CW, do you see any the wave vector change or
no?
It's the same?
The in plane wave vector, this 0.3, stays the same. There's recent measurements from the Stanford that just got posted on the archive a few weeks ago, where they applied an even higher magnetic field, 27 Tesla, I believe. And what happens is that the out-of-plane wave vector So how the CDW order is stacked between planes seems to change.
But not the in-plane.
But not the in-plane wave vector, okay? Why the change is out of plane is not so clear. It could be that you've induced vortices that then kind of align your CDW order somehow, but I'm not sure. All right, so we got involved in this very shortly after the initial measurements of the Milano group and Bielsen Chang and St. Hayden. We did soft X-ray measurements on this compound. This was a pretty high purity sample, so we showed that this density wave order was also observed in these high purity, more pristine materials. We provided some of the spectroscopy that really showed that this density wave order was native to the copper oxide planes as opposed to the chain layer or some other part of the structure. And then we got some insight into the microscopic character of the CDW order. So we sort of worked out this stuff about what the probe is actually sensitive to, and it seems to be sensitive to these energy shifts as opposed to a clear modulation of charge density. So that was YBCO. So now we have very compelling evidence that the CDW order is occurring in YBCO. Somewhat stimulated by that, people started to look seriously for a CDW order with scattering techniques, resin X-ray scattering, in bismuth-based compounds where people had seen for years CDW order from STM, but those people always, people like Seamus had to always deal with criticism about this potentially being a surface effect. So now with the bulk probe, there's clear evidence that there's a CDW order in the bulk of these materials, and it has the same Q vectors and correlation lengths as had been measured for years by the tunneling groups. So what people are seeing from tunneling then is really something associated with the bulk of the materials, and really seems to be very much related to what's seen in YBCO. Just this year, I worked by Eduardo Solonetto and Andrea Domicelli's group, also found charge density wave order in electron doped cuprates, which at least to me was really quite unexpected, a big surprise. And I think, I don't know what the consequences of this are exactly, but I think this should constrain what would be an appropriate theoretical description of charge density wave order. You'd have to have something that would work on both the electron dope and both sides. Okay.
What's the period of this CDW? It's like a 2 lattice and 4 lattice.
The period is around 0.25. It's somewhat broad. And then this seems to be associated with hot spots in the Fermi surface. In these electron dope cuprates, it had been measured many years ago, the Fermi surface with Angerskov photo emission, and there seemed to be hot spots associated with the antiferromagnetic wave vector. And the Q vector here is somewhat consistent with those hotspots. So it seems like the fermiology of these compounds is important for establishing the Q vector, at least in YBCO visco and in the electron. Okay, so what I want to go over is what's a generic and common to these cuprate materials, and what I think are a few of the key differences that we need to try and understand. So one of the common elements is the onset temperature of the CPW order, or at least what we can resolve as the onset above some background. So here is a phase diagram in YBCO on the one side, showing the onset temperature versus doping. And we can see it's forming sort of a dome-like structure peaked near 1/8 doping. Similarly, in the here's a phase diagram from your europium-doped LSCO. They also see a dome-like structure peaked around 1/8 doping. So this just seems to be a common element of these materials. It's not clear whether this 1/8 doping is somehow a magic number, like a commensurate number, and some importance should be placed on this being commensurate, or whether this is just some dome-like structure or crossover between regimes, and there's nothing particularly special about 0.125. Similarly, you know, if we look at the TC dome, there's a dome-like structure. I wouldn't really put any fundamental importance on TC being maximal at 0.17. So it's questionable whether 0.125 is also something that is of fundamental importance. The intensity of the CDW peak is also peaked around this 1/8 doping. So here's a sort of a scatter of different peak intensity data on a log plot on one side shown against TC. And it's peaked around 1/8 doping. And that that peak in the maximal intensity of the CDW order as somewhat coincident with a dip or a suppression in TC versus doping in YBCO. And that same sort of suppression in TC versus doping is also what is observed in the 1/8 doped light blend phase cube rates. So here's the intensity in the light blue of the CDW order versus doping in LBCO, and here's that suppression of superconductivity coinciding with that.
Some comparison. I mean, so here the TC suppression is much larger, of course.
Yeah, so here there's much more dramatic suppression of TC and 1/8 doping than in YBCO.
Absolute units, what is the intensity here compared to, is there a way of comparing in the same experiment?
Okay, so I'll come back to that in a second, maybe the relative intensities of the CDW order between the different impurities.
Okay.
In both cases, there's a similar magnetic field dependence. So I showed this YBCO data showing a field that enhances suppresses superconductivity and enhances the CDW order. Marcus Hooker at Brookhaven has done similar stuff in LBCO in a sample where it's a slightly higher doping than 1/8 doping, and TC is in the 20 to 30 Kelvin range. And in this case, when they apply a magnetic field above TC, not much happens. Below TC, you get this enhancement of the CDW order, qualitatively identical or quite similar to what's happening in YBCO. So there seems to be a very similar competition between the charge density wave order and superconductivity happening in these two materials. In terms of the intensity and the short range order, so first off, I guess I'll cover intensity. So here I'm showing our measurements of CDW order, a bright peak intensity from this compound, neodymium-doped LSCO. So this is the same material that John Tranquana first saw CDW order in back in 1995. Same doping, same composition on a different crystal. And here's a 1/8 doped LBCO, or YBCO, sorry. And these are measured with a similar, the same detector basically, the same instrument. So it's not a strictly an apples to apples comparison, but it's it'll give you a bit of a sense of how an individual bright peak compares in these two materials. So they have, relative to a high temperature background, which is just measuring some fluorescence, they have pretty similar intensity, in fact, for these peaks. So arguably the YBCO is a little bit more intense than the LNSCO. And they also have similar correlation lengths. So the width of this peak is giving the inverse correlation length. So a sharper peak would be a longer correlation length. And here the correlation length in this particular measurement is around 50 angstroms. In LNSCO, correlation length is, for this sample, is 73 angstroms. These are pretty similar magnitudes. And that should be placed in the context that the level of disorder in these materials is really quite different. So I argued that YBCO is cleaner and more pristine and certainly has much, much larger mean-free paths than this compound here, which has this quite a large concentration of a large size ion in neodymium that's going to introduce a large scattering rate and if you want a large peaking potential for some charge order. So it's a bit of a surprise that the correlation lengths are within a fudge factor identical, okay? To address these questions yesterday a bit further about the role of disorder, we did do a study of YBCO, and this published in PRL last year, of changing the level of oxygen disorder and a material in YVCL without changing anything else. So we kept the same whole building, the same physical crystal, and we've just heated it up, annealed it without taking it out of our instrument, and quenched it back down to a lower temperature. And that changes the distribution of oxygen in the chain layer and will change the disorder potential in the material. And it turns out that in YVCO, in these materials, the level of oxygen disorder is the primary defect. So it's not like there's some other contaminant in it. That changing the oxygen disorder will affect the scattering rate and seems to be an important defect. So when we do that, somewhat to our surprise, this had no effect on the correlation length of the CDW order. So what's shown here are measurements. We've subtracted the background, and I've just scaled this disordered measurement by a constant factor. So disordering the oxygen affected the intensity of the CDW bright peak, but didn't affect the peak position or the correlation length. It also doesn't affect the temperature dependence. So we measured carefully the temperature dependence over a whole range of the temperature in the ordered and disordered state. And if I just scale by a constant factor, they agree quite nicely. So to me, this indicates that there may be, at least in some region of the phase diagram for this material and over some range of temperature, it could be that there's a more intrinsic origin for the short-range character of the CDW order. Disorder may play a role, but it could also be that there's a phase competition with superconductivity is making it short-range, or pneumaticity, or some other frustration that we haven't fully identified yet. I don't know, maybe Sabir will agree or disagree with this characterization, but certainly this model that Sabir developed for fluctuation or competition between CDW order and superconductivity gives short-range CDW order in the absence of any disorder, at least for a good part of the temperature range. And that's coming about due to the competition with superconductivity. So I think that could really be accounting for at least part of this correlation that you've been like to see.
Do you have data for temperature dependence of this orbit or this scale?
That correlation
like temperature, yeah.
You can't really see it. So unfortunately, the figures are all, the resolution is a bit messed up for some reason. This is our measured correlation length versus temperature, okay? And it becomes broad at high temperature. The correlation length is highest at TC, and then it becomes, broad again at lower temperature once you get into the superconducting state. And if one applies a magnetic field, the magnetic field enhances the correlation. Okay? Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
It's also a case that there's some unidirectional character to a density wave order. So I argued that there's unidirectional density wave order in the length of the base peak rates, and that's associated with this tilting of the copper oxygen octahedra. I probably won't have time to get back to this at the end, but we have some new insight into this. There also is now growing evidence for a unidirectional character to the CDW order in YVCO as well. So the first measurements, the ones I showed, one of the first slides, the scattering measurements by Sharon Galliot, were at a doping where it seemed that the intensity of the CDW order was equal for a Q vector along the A versus the B axis. So the H peak versus the K peak had almost equal intensity. So that's what's shown here. These are nice measurements by Blanco Canosa. They've measured the Q vector along A and B for different dopings, going from high doping to low doping. And around this 1/8 doping, there's roughly equal intensity, which seems to suggest a checkerboard-like state. But if we go to a low doping, the H peak drops out, and we just have a K peak. So there's some just from the intensity of the bright peaks, there's this evidence for a unidirectional density wave order for at least part of the phase diagram.
Is this direction biased by the directions of the chains? Or?
Yeah, so this material, it's important to consider that YBCO is orthorhombic, okay? So somehow this orthorhombicity is favoring the CDW order aligning along a particular direction at a particular doping. We don't quite know why or how.
But is it always parallel to the general perpendicular? Well, you get both, right?
What's that?
You get CDW both perpendicular and not parallel to the chain.
Yeah, so with this doping, we get them both perpendicular and parallel to the chains. At lower doping, we just see CDW border where it's the Q vector is parallel to the chains. So we get a K peak but no V.
So in the bidirectional case, you could say it's not there dependent?
Yeah, we don't know yet whether we have something that there's one layer where it's oriented along the A axis and the next layer is oriented along the B axis, or whether we have small patches where the patches change their orientation. These are remain open questions. So the scattering measurements are such that they would sort of average over the bulk. Depending on the out of plane Q dependence, you may be able to distinguish different patterns, but as yet, I think this is unclear. There's other evidence too. I should note Ricardo Coleman and Andrea Domicelli, their group, have done some measurements looking at the width of the bright peaks along the different directions, and it seems that the blobs of density wave order are elliptical, which would be most consistent with a unidirectional density wave order, or at least that's what we argue. If I have time, I'll note another aspect of the unidirectional character of the CDW order, and that is that the orbital symmetry of the density wave order differs for the HP versus the KP. We've also done a doping dependence of the CDW order, and this is as yet unpublished, but if we go down to very, very low doping, this oxygen 6.335 sample. Now this is getting very close to the superconductor to non-superconductor phase transition, and TC is not only 12 Kelvin, we again just see the K peak and not the H peak. And this is in a sample where there is no oxygen ordering in the chain layer. The material is still orthorhombic, but it has no ordered chains anymore. Okay. So another feature of the density wave order that I want to discuss is the Q vector, the incommensurability of how this varies with doping. So this is a compilation of work by our group and several other groups showing the Q vector in YBCO versus doping, and there's a decreasing trend with increasing doping. So this would be like one over the period of the density wave order. This same sort of trend was observed earlier on by Seamus Davis and others. So here's the Q vector extracted from STM versus doping in bismuth 2212, and it also decreases with increasing doping. And they noted that this seems to be associated with the locations of where Fermi arcs intersect this diagonal zone boundary, or in other words, the location of Fermi surface arcs or hotspots. So other people have also noted this correlation. So how the Fermi surface evolves versus doping and the location of these hotspots is consistent with the Q vector of the CDW order. And specifically, the Q vector of the CDW order would be such that it would connect hotspots in neighboring Fermi zones. So sort of as depicted here. So Ricardo Coleman and Bismuth 2201, they did both ARPES, some modeling, and the resin X-ray scattering, and they also sort of note this downward trend and the connection of this Q vector with the locations of the hotspots observed in angular bulk formation. So, yeah, so the Q vector would then be associated somehow with permeology. So this should be contrasted with the Lampton-based Q rates, where it's been known for some time that the incommensurability of the CW order increases with increasing doping, so-called Yamada plot. It has been argued that the incommensurability increases and then plateaus Other experiments, such as these ones here, sort of maybe indicate more of a gradual increase in the Q vector. And certainly, if you go to higher doping, we've measured samples with I think reasonable accuracy, and the Q vector exceeds 0.25. In europium doped LSCO of a doping of 0.15, Q vector is 0.26. It's not stuck at 0.25. Okay. So understanding this the dichotomy or difference in the both the magnitude and the doping evolution is I think an open question. One of the other perhaps most striking differences between the two compounds is the presence or absence of static spin density wave order. In the lanthanum-based cuprates I showed earlier, there's this spin density wave order that's associated with the CDW order. But in BISCO or YBCO, there's a spin gap and no, at least at 1-8 doping, there's no evidence for any spin density wave order, static spin density wave order that has any association with the CDW order. So I think that these are sort of the two key differences between the systems, but otherwise they look strikingly similar. So I think many in the community, perhaps for historical reasons, would like to think of the stripes in LBCO as something different than what it, than the charge density wave order that is seen in YBCO. From in my mind, that's implausible. That we really need some common description. So the basic physics, the basic ingredients for CDW order and YBCO, some modification of that theory should also give stripes in LBCO. So that's the challenge for the theory, so come up with a theory that gives some study. So one other aspect that I'm going to try and cover, and so I only have a few minutes left, so I'll try and get through the orbital symmetry and then I'll leave out the mapticity. One other aspect that I think is related to these differences is the orbital symmetry of the density wave order. And this we're going to talk about is contained in two papers. One that's recently come out in Nature Materials after quite some time and a bit of revision. And then the other is a work that is what I'm going to spend most of my time talking about, that is mostly our work from our group, and that's hopefully to be accepted soon. So the question is, and Spear introduced this yesterday, that sort of you can't really see, I sort of have really faint orbitals here. The idea is that we want to investigate the orbital form factor, the orbital symmetry of the density wave order. So if I asked, if I was asked to write down what the orbital occupation of the CDW order should look like in real space, including both the copper sites and the oxygen sites. If I was asked this several years ago, I would have written down something like this, where there's just a sinusoidal modulation of the charge on every site, where all the sites are one in phase with each other. So this would correspond to a NATS symmetry CDW. So we can break this up into the copper sublattice and the oxygen sublattice, and plot those separately. So that's just the same image. I've just sort of split it into the different sublattices. And in Sabir's terminology, this would correspond to an S symmetry CDW in the top and an S prime symmetry CDW on the bottom. But Sabir and others, so Kevin was here last month. She also has theory involved in this. Matt was heavily involved in this, as Sabir discussed. They propose another very intriguing possibility that one could have a desymmetry density modulation where the PX, modulation of the PX, PX versus the PY orbitals would be out of phase with each other. There'd be a pi phase shift in the scattering for these two sublattices. And that gives us the plus minus characteristic of a desymmetry. So evidence for this, I think very compelling evidence for this, Samir talked about yesterday, was from the SPM measurements of Seamus Davis's group, and looking at both the real space pictures and the correspondence of those real space images with a d-symmetry density wave order calculation, and then also looking at the Fourier transform of that and the Frank piece one gets, and that's consistent with a dominant d-symmetry density wave order and not with a dominant S prime symmetry density wave order. Other evidence exploring this was this collaboration with Ricardo Coleman, and they use azimuthal angle dependent Risen X-ray scattering, which I'll try to describe to some extent. These measurements are the copper L edge, which has some consequence or impact that I may not be able to get into. But basically, there's these plots here of the Risen scattering intensity with different polarizations and the ratio of those polarizations versus some change in the geometry of the material. And these data points are some intensity, and then they fit this to curves with a dominant d-symmetry density wave order, the solid curve, versus a dominant s-prime symmetry density wave order, the dash curve, and there's a better agreement with the dominant d-symmetry density wave order, favoring a d-symmetry CDW order in YPCM. Okay, so I'm not going to talk about that too much more. What I instead want to talk about is LBCL and what the symmetry of the density wave order is in this compound. So I'm going to use, again, this Risen X-ray scattering technique. And what we do with Risen X-ray scattering is I haven't mentioned this up to this point, and this is an important aspect of this technique. We tune the energy of our X-rays so that we're on an X-ray absorption edge. And what happens when we tune the X-ray energy is the atomic scattering form factor, which enters into our structure factor. So this is a sort of an expression one might pull out of the tell. But if we examine this quantity here, that's how strongly an X-ray scatters off a particular element. That quantity, if one goes on resonance, should be thought of as a tensor quantity, and the magnitude of scattering would depend on the projection of the incident and the scattered photon polarization on the crystallographic axes of your sample. So one way to think about this would be think of it as an index of refraction in an anisotropic material, which we think about as a tensor quantity. So now if we want to do scattering, and we're going to do scattering of the oxygen K edge, so that we're sensitive to the oxygen 2p poles, an oxygen px orbital has a different symmetry scattering tensor than an oxygen py orbital. So now if we combine with X-rays polarized along different crystallographic axes, we'll have a different sensitivity to oxygen px versus the oxygen py sublies in the material. So, specifically, we can measure the amplitude and the phase of scattering of the X-rays from these different sublattices. And instead of labeling them oxygen PX versus oxygen PY, I'm labeling them with respect to the Q vector, or the propagation direction of the CDW order, as oxygen parallel versus oxygen perpendicular. And the quantities that I can really extract from a measurement are, I've sort of written down here, and these are sort of analogous to a structure factor, but just picking out the different components of this tensor. And the ones parameter T perpendicular will correspond to scattering from the oxygen perpendicular sublattice, and T parallel from the oxygen parallel sublattice. So I can measure the amplitude and the phase relationship between these. So, and specifically what we can do then is relate those quantities, which I can measure, to the relative magnitude and of the D versus the S prime symmetry modulation of the CDW work. Okay, so the actual experiment involves taking our incident X-rays and aligning the incident polarization perpendicular to the scattering plane, we call that sigma, or parallel to the scattering plane, that's called pi, and then we rotate our sample around in this angle, this azimuthal angle phi, in a geometry such that the Q vector remains fixed. So we're sitting at a fixed Q vector, in this case 0.236, 0, and I think it's 0.611, okay, for the oxygen KF. So this was a sort of an approach that was pioneered or advocated for by Ricardo Coleman in that recently published Nature Materials paper. So here's the intensity of the scattering for the sigma versus the pi geometries, and there's a pretty dramatic change in the intensity as we change the angle for which there's a focal polarization. So here I've plotted those intensities versus angle, and we get these nice curves. And the important thing is the ratio of these two, we fit that, and it fit to that to this data, this I pi over I sigma versus angle, highly constrains this parameter here, Q parallel over Q per, the relative scattering between the perpendicular and parallel sublattices. So what we find from these ratios is that the scattering is larger for the perpendicular versus the parallel sublattice. So that indicates that it's not a strictly S prime symmetry density wave order. There's some deviation from a pure S prime symmetry density wave order. The fact that it's positive indicates that it's predominantly S prime symmetry density wave order as opposed to a predominantly D symmetry density wave order. Although if we, so here's sort of what we might have expected for a dominant D symmetry density wave order in blue. And if we put this into our simple calculation and offer these parameters to the orbital symmetry, we get the D component being about 1/4 of the S prime component. Okay, so the question is, why would these be different? And my can't-wavy answers to this are spin density wave order. I think this has something to do with this difference in orbital symmetry. So the argument goes sort of like this. If I wanted to construct a spin charge stripe, that's basically coming about because there's some correlation between the local charge and the local antiferromagnetic order. So if I have regions of low charge, I have a stronger antiferromagnetic interaction. Regions of high charge or high hole density, I have a weaker antiferromagnetic interaction. And then I could tile some spin order onto my charge order as such, where here I've got a strong antiferromagnetic order, here I've got a weak antiferromagnetic order, and you may in fact have a ferrule interaction between these two copper sites. But then this order also has to be two-dimensional. So it's a unidirectional stripe where I've got a single Q vector, but I need to have antiferromagnetic order on both the Y and the X direction in order to get something consistent with the neutron scattering measurements. So this is sort of what we have for the spin charge stripe. So now if I want to do that kind of same tiling or use the same argument on a d-symmetry density wave order, I have a problem. So if I have a strong antiferromagnetic order interaction, where there's this low charge density, so between these two copper sites, I have a weak antiferromagnetic interaction along the y direction, and I think this should be less favorable to stabilizing some static spin order. I think it's more likely that some other magnetic ground state would occur in this compound, or that one would have no magnetic order at all. So some theoretical support for this coming from a different direction is from Samir, and it's a work on a three-band model with Thompson, and if they introduce some static antiferromagnetic order into their model, that seems to push the CDW order in towards the dominant S prime symmetry as opposed to a D symmetry. From a different perspective, Mike Lawler and Una Kim and Arun and co-authors also find a subdominant D symmetry in a model that has both spin and charge stripes. Finally, maybe I'll end with this. I think an open question remains whether the CDW orbital symmetry plays a role in the competition with superconductivity. So naively, I can imagine that an S prime symmetry density wave order may compete more strongly with superconductivity than a D symmetry CDW order. So without doing any calculations or thinking about this rigorously at all, one could just consider that the asymmetry superconductivity more naturally coexists with a asymmetry, some other asymmetry order parameter, and less naturally with an asymmetry order parameter. Alternately, maybe these things compete for spectral weight along the Fermi surface in different ways, or maybe we should, maybe in a Bell approach might be to think about this as an impurity potential, and if you had sort of a, just impose some asymmetry versus nest symmetry tiling on your lattice, how would Cooper pairs and quasi particles behave in these different environments? I can imagine that a asymmetry modulation would be more compatible with superconductivity than S prime symmetry modulation. But working that out in detail is a job for other people. Okay, so maybe I'll stop there and take any questions.
So you explain this charge order physics. Is there any signal for time PT violation in your experiments? Because there are other experiments which claim. So is it possible to accommodate the
time reversal symmetry breakdown?
Yeah.
For example,
a complex D. S plus ID mixing.
Yeah, I don't think we have any evidence for a
experiment.
I haven't come up with a way to identify that in the measurements. So we could be sensitive to things like chirality, and possibly time reversal symmetry breaking. So these probes can be very sensitive to magnetism, for instance. And that gives rise to a different symmetry to these scattering tensors. So this sort of tensor would have a different form when you sum over them if you have a chiral system or magnetism or whatnot. And then we give you a different model, and then we have different signatures in this azimuthal angle dependence.
Because you
have no indication that that's significant.
Because you try to model it as S plus P admixture.
Yes.
And in principle, you can have a complex admixture.
Like
S plus ID in superconductivity breaks chirality.
I'll have to explore that. I think, I'll look into that again.
So for this CDW you're talking about, it's a column or checkerboard CDW.
I think in YBCO, it's not entirely clear, but it's now evident that there is some unidirectional aspect to the density waveform. So it's definitely not a simple checkerboard.
Yeah, but in that case, since the rotation symmetry is broken, so what do you mean by D-symmetry now?
Well,
because there's a preferred direction. That's you can only do maybe 180 degree rotation. 90 degree rotation just changing the order totally.
So here's work this theory. You can define you can break this down in a pretty well defined fashion for a checkerboard or for a unidirectional order.
Mixing of the two.
There is always mixing, and so actually he was also showing data of the ratio of the two components. So there's always both S prime and D mix, because it's never it's always broken.
In a sense, D symmetry CDW is not clearly defined for the checkerboard.
It's just a question of number. It's okay, maybe symmetry. Maybe we should call them form factors. There's a D form factor and S form factor,
I think.
And just a question of what is the ratio of their values. We can have various ways of estimating that. From STM measurements, the D is about 5 times larger than the S.
Is the D the one searchable within the unit scale? S is the more searchable within the.
Yeah, it's intra-unit, that's correct. it's an infra unit, so.
The other one.
Yeah, but this is kind of a unit that we're talking about.
Yeah, so to some extent, the key vector is an intra-unit cell aspect of it, and we're probing some intra-unit cell property of the density inverse. But yeah, reasonable.
So for your picture, you have a blue and a red. What the meaning?
The
density state is above the average or below the average?
Yes.
It doesn't.
Yes.
I see.
Okay, so white, which is not really coming out nicely in this image, would be then just the average velocity. So the orbital occupation you'd have at high temperature above the CDW. Okay.
So it's really just a density, not the phase of the orbital, just a density of the occupation.
Yes.
But I thought the color stands for the phase.
Well,
it's the red.
It's the phase of the charge density, not of the orbital wave function.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Does it mean that you go beyond single band and you have to invoke oxygen orbitals separately to explain this?
Yeah.
You can think of it in two ways. I mean, either you can say, the way Dave's been talking about it, say this is a copper site here, and a copper site here, and an oxygen site here. So let's call this 1, 2, and 3. So Dave's been just measuring, C dagger 3, C 3, expectation value, and C dagger 1, C 1, and C dagger 2, C 2. So what Dave is plotting are the values of these expectation values as a modulus. But now if you had a one band model, you could sort of say that this is basically the same as C dagger 1, C 2 plus C dagger 2, C 1. So you can also define it in a one band model as some kind of bond density variable. So if I did the whole calculation one band model, I would just make the same plots, but where the oxygen is, I would plot this quantity.
And will the sound change when you go from?
Sorry? Yeah, I mean, you'll get the same picture. So we've done the calculations both in three band models and one band models, and you get pictures that look like much like this. Yeah, and they look the same, the two calculations are not very different. I mean, in the one band model, roughly speaking, this is especially the kinetic energy of an electron hopping from here to there.
Directly between.
Is the same logo in terms of symmetry every day as the charge density on the oxygen side. There will be, physically in any model, there will be correlation, but they will be tied to each other.
Yeah, so I think Jared in this paper, it's PRL 2013, he wrote down a formulation of the density wave order and decomposing that into the different orbital form factor components. And that was worked out in a single band model, but that model, that expression can be easily, it's super generic and can be adapted for a three band model. The things that I guess it doesn't really strictly incorporate would be out of plane orbitals. Is that correct?
No, yeah, there's nothing out of plane.
Yeah, okay. So that's perhaps the one main assumption that may or may not be relevant, that it's a 2D representation.
The way I was asking this question is that Chandra Verma's black weight current model, you cannot get it in one bad model. You have to invoke
identity.
Okay, I disagree with that. You can certainly write down that state in one band model. Now, whether it's energetically preferred in a mean field theory in one band model is a different question. But you can certainly write down such a state using the non-variable.
Yeah, you can write chiral current carrying states. But the way Chandra Verma is not here, I'm not supposed to talk to you. You have to have an independent existence of p orbital, decoupled from d orbital. That's why three band is fundamental there. You can't do it in one band.
I've heard him make that claim, but I disagree with it. I think his state can also be defined for one band model.
But they are different. Okay, we'll discuss.
I mean, maybe I'll mention another thing. You're just looking at these pictures. You know, this makes, you know, look like B. The thought of this is B. You would say this should be the negative of that. That's a D wave. But if you look more carefully at the picture, that's not really true. This is the negative of that. But this is not quite the negative. This color is not quite the same as that. That's because the B is multiplied by this modulation.
Yeah.
And this is a little bit offset. And so it's really, it's very subtle. I mean, it's not exactly D. It's a little bit different. And when you do the Fourier transform in the STM, that's actually important. That's really what comes out. It does look exactly like this in this subtle.
So it's as subtle as the density modulation.
Well, there's two modulations. There's the D form factor, and then there's a
other,
they multiply.
Yeah, so it's an entry unit cell and an entry unit cell and character that.
And that's really crucial to the way you do the analysis of the STM as well.
So your disorder, the disorder experiment shows that really the scale of this CDW is some kind of finite range. It's not a disorder, but probably something else.
Like
but then implies that the ground state, the Schumann-like place, you cannot.
Same origin.
The order just cannot coexist with the Schumann-like place. So